Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It was a five-second crime, decades in the making. What does the murder of North Korea's Kim Jong-nam tell us about his half-brother, Kim Jong-un? And what does it tell us about the world's next nuclear-powered dictatorship? Tune in to tomorrow night's Frontline on SDPB-TV for the new investigation, North Korea's Deadly Dictator. Joining us now, Jane McMullen. She's producer and director of the program. We're reaching her in New York. Jane McMullen, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi there. It's very nice to be with you.
For those who don't remember, before we put it into context as far as who the victim of this crime is, let's talk about the crime itself. It's an international airport and sort of an unusual way to commit a crime.
Sure. So it's about 9 o'clock in the morning, Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. It's the Terminal 2 of their international airport. And an unremarkable looking man wearing a sort of blue, powder blue jacket walks through the door and into the departure hall. And within seconds of arriving in the departure hall, he goes over to the self-check-in kiosk, and it's there that two women approach him and attack him, and one of them appears to put some sort of cloth or something over his face. And he realizes very quickly what's happened. He goes to find the security guards, and he explains to them, and you can see him on the CCTV, on the security camera footage, explaining to them what's happened to him. They take him to the clinic, within a couple of hours of the attack, he's died. He had a seizure. He passed out, and then on the way to hospital, he died. Yeah. I mean, this is a brazen, audacious attack, very, very, very public, in front of many CCTV cameras, many security cameras. And it's really the story of a spy thriller. It's an absolutely extraordinary story.
Right. And all this is really before we even know who the victim is, who the target of the assassination attempt is, it seems to be, as soon as we find out who it is. And when does that sort of become revealed, that this is a half-brother of the North Korean dictator?
Right. So the Malaysian authorities try to identify him, and it's really only the following day that South Korean media break the story, and then the news goes around the world after that. And the victim is carrying a passport with the name Kim Chol, a North Korean passport with the name Kim Chol, which is how the authorities begin to refer to him. But as the images went around the world and the news began to come out about this attack, it soon became clear that he was really somebody else. He was a man called Kim Jong-nam, who is the older half-brother of the current leader of North Korea.
All right, so let's put it into context now. We go back. This is North Korea. This is three generations of dictators. He's the son of Kim Jong-il and an actress. Tell us a little bit about Kim Jong-nam's, we're talking the victim now here, his childhood.
So Kim Jong-nam, as you say, was the son of Kim Jong-il and a very famous North Korean actress. And so she was actually a sort of mistress. They weren't officially married. And he grew up in secrecy. He was living in a palace, a royal complex in Pyongyang. But nobody was really allowed to know of his existence, not even members of the family. So he grew up with only a very small number of people to talk to. And he eventually was allowed to leave the country to go to school, first in Moscow and then in Geneva, Switzerland, which was where he came into contact with a whole load of other people at the International School of Geneva. And I was lucky to be able to interview a couple of his school friends who describe this guy they didn't even know was North Korean. One of them said they thought he was a Chinese guy called Lee. And he was age 15. He had what looked like a fake driver's license, and he was driving around in this Mercedes. And they all loved the fact that he had this this car, and they were all terribly jealous and desperate to get behind the wheel of it.
I cannot believe you found childhood friends of his. How did that come about? And they really paint the picture of him as a person outside the regime. It's so fascinating. How did you manage that?
Well, we reached out to people from all walks of all parts of Kim Jong-nam's life. And they were two tremendously nice guys who wanted to tell the world about their friend, which is a really nice thing to do.
And they sort of thought that he wasn't maybe cut out to be the next North Korean dictator because he was maybe a little too nice. What do we know about his personality? And then we'll talk about his sort of behavior and you know, how he made his money in the future. But was he a gentler person because of his education in Moscow and beyond?
So the impression that I've had of him is that he was a very social guy. He was a thoughtful guy. He's also quite a complicated character. He was a playboy. He liked casinos. He liked wine. But he also thought deeply about his country and cared a lot about his country. And his experiences, first his education, but then the fact that he then was able to live in China. So he spent some time in North Korea, but then he moved to China. He saw in China the rapid explosion of the Chinese economy, the explosive growth in China. And he wrote later of how this inspired him to try to push for North Korea to follow and to open up, liberalize, reform the economy. And this was something that he discussed with his father. And his father, I think, felt that this would be detrimental to the future of the Kim family and the dynasty. So they didn't pursue it in the way that Kim Jong-nam wanted.
Do you happen to know if he had a relationship with his grandfather, with Kim Il-sung?
This is something that we don't go into in the film. I can't give you a sort of definitive answer.
Yeah.
I believe that he did. I believe that he was. There was a period of great secrecy, as I mentioned early on, and then Kim Jong Il was able to reveal his son to the rest of the family. And at that point, I believe that he did have some sort of relationship with Kim Il Sung. But this is something that was outside the scope of the film. We weren't able to go into that in too much detail.
Right. So let's talk about Kim Jong-un and how does he rise to power to replace his father versus Kim Jong-nam?
So Kim Jong-il was the father. He didn't really talk about succession. And, you know, there wasn't much of a plan for succession while Kim Jong-il was healthy and while he was exercising power. In 2008... he had a debilitating stroke, and they had to start thinking about a succession plan. And they decided there was a decision that led to Kim Jong-un, who was the youngest of the three sons, being appointed as the next leader. But Kim Jong-un was at this point, he was in his 20s. He was very, very young. And they had to start a sort of training program to give him the sort of skills and expertise necessary to rule North Korea. But they also had to try and give him a power base, develop his relationships within the North Korean elite. But this training was cut short because just 3 years later, in December 2011, Kim Jong-il died. And so Kim Jong-un was still only in his 20s when he was declared supreme leader. And that, you know, he was surrounded at this point by officials from his father's reign who were much, much, much older than him. And a lot of experts in America, in the West, thought, how is he going to be able to survive this? There's going to be some kind of a coup. The regime's going to fall apart. But actually what we've seen sort of 6 years later, 5-6 years later, is that he has managed to consolidate his his power and, you know, and rule quite effectively.
Through what? Through brutality, essentially, through executions, through getting rid of anyone who stands in his way. How did he consolidate that power to maintain it?
So one of the things that we've seen him do, as you say, is a purge of officials, people that are considered to be a threat to him. So one of the most prominent of those purges was his uncle, Jang Song-taek, who was executed in 2013. And then, obviously, his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, who was assassinated in February. But the other thing he's done, which is very much part of the same effort at power consolidation, is to further the nuclear program. So this was something that his grandfather started and his father continued. And Kim Jong-un, I believe we were told by experts for this film that he has stated that he would like to complete the program. I believe this year he's been saying that he wants to complete the nuclear program.
And that's fairly standard for this family to always be looking back and completing or moving forward with the, you know, initiatives of the, you know, the great leader at the beginning. What is his definition of complete? Is it ending in an attack? Is it just ending in we are as North Korea have nuclear weapons? So there, what does complete mean to Kim Jong-un?
Complete means, I believe it means that they have the ability to threaten the United States, the continental United States, with a nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile. So it's just having the technology to be able to do that. Let's be clear about something. They don't want to use nuclear weapons because the moment they start to use them, it's game over for the North Korean regime.
Right. That's what I was getting at. That's what I'm wondering. Let's go back for a moment to this crime and tell me why Kim Jong-nam is a target. Is he just a target because he's a half-brother, or is it his behavior that's drawing attention?
There are many reasons. So he was the older half-brother, this is a Confucian culture where in which, you know, an older brother would have legitimacy as a, you know, the potential other, you know, alternative leader. He was also someone who had been critical of Kim Jong-un. And we have an interview in the film with a Japanese journalist, Yoji Gomi, who happened to exchange almost 150 emails with Kim Jong-nam in which he criticized the third generation succession in North Korea and criticized the direction that the country was moving in and reiterated this this passion for bringing about economic reforms to North Korea. He was also somebody who, even if he may not have been, you know, desirous of actually taking power in North Korea himself, was seen by other people as a potential alternative leader. So there's some evidence that the Chinese, for instance, had him as a sort of possible, you know, alternative in the future. Not this was never a sort of formalized plan, but, you know, so there was a possibility that he might be, you know, seen as an alternative if that was necessary. And then one of the other interesting things that has emerged is there was a group of defectors who approached Kim Jong-nam over the last few months to lead a government in exile for North Korea. And as one of our interviewees says, he said no, apparently. We think he said no, but the very fact that he even talked to them might have been considered a threat to the regime. So there's any number of reasons why this might have happened now. And the other very interesting possible reason is that the school friends in Geneva had understood that he was hoping to move to Europe, which would have meant, to all intents and purposes, that he was defecting, which could have posed a threat to Kim Jong-un as well.
Did the United States and our allies miss an opportunity there with Kim Jong-nam? Was there something they should have moved on, seen the signs of, and maybe protected him, gotten him out of there for our benefit?
So, very interesting question. I'm not sure how the United States would have protected him, but he was under some measure of protection from China where he was living. And sure. There are some reports, some rumors that he has actually been warned that something might be, that he might be, there might be some threat to him, but he appeared to think that he could continue to travel freely without security.
Hmm. Let's finish with a little more details about this crime because if you're just tuning in, it's Frontline's North Korea's deadly dictator. Jane McMullen is my guest. She's director and producer of the film. It's such an intriguing crime story, like you said, an international spy novel in the making. What happens to the women who commit this crime? What do they claim, and what's their fate?
So within 3 days of the attack, Malaysian police had arrested the women. And the story that they then told was really extraordinary. Siti Aisyah is a 25-year-old Indonesian woman. And she claimed that 6 weeks earlier, she had been approached by a guy who told her that he was Japanese. And he'd offered her work on a TV prank show, or YouTube prank show, so a hidden camera prank show. And in the 6 weeks after that meeting, they practiced pranks on people that Siti thought were sort of unsuspecting members of the public. And that culminated in this day on February the 13th, when she thought she was just going to play another prank. It turned out that it was Kim Jong-nam, and she later found out that he had died. Now, this is her version of events. Malaysian police have charged her and the other lady, Duan Thi Huong, who's from Vietnam, with murder. The trial has just started, and if they're found guilty, they face the death penalty.
Hmm. What do we know about Kim Jong-un and North Korea leadership, the dictatorship there, from this incident, from how it was carried out, that we didn't know before? What's more clear now?
Well, look, I think there's a sort of stereotype of Kim Jong-un as, the sort of the fat, crazy kid. And I think what we've seen is that he is somebody who is extremely rational, extremely calculating, and prepared to go to great lengths in order to further his own power and the survival of the regime. And one thing you have to know is that there's never been an assassination or an execution of a member of the Kim family before. So this is something new, and I think it shows his determination to further his own power. And that's the same, it's all tied up with the nuclear program. What we have to understand with the nuclear program is he's only going to do acts that further his own power and the survival of the regime. Everything he does is connected to that.
Huh. Jane McMullen is the producer and director of Frontline's North Korea's Deadly Dictator. It airs tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Mountain on SDPB TV. Jane McMullen, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.